I believe it's the design of the organizers that we have a general discussion of the papers in each session toward the end of the session. So I want to ask you all to take a deep breath now and lock in your question for Sarah as I introduce the next speaker. That speaker is Eustace Fetcher. Eustace Fetcher is a professor of modern German, Neue Germanistik, at the University of Mannheim. He was, until 5 years ago, at the Center for Literary and Cultural Research in Berlin. He has published widely in the areas of literature and the history of the senses. I asked him if his understanding of the history of the senses was embedded to the Frankfurt School, and he said, no, I'm a philologist. So that gives you some sense of his orientation. He's a comparatist. He works between English and German especially. He's published an article about imagination between Milton and Kant, which I think I'm going to go look up. He's written on Sebald, another interest, I think, of that many of us share with him. I noticed that he's done a series of lectures on literature and the acoustic media, which I gather will be part of what he's talking about today. He says that what he's offering us today is not formally part of a project yet, but may well become so, and that may depend, of course, on you and how well you help him out here today in the discussion period. So his topic is sound masks, impersonation via voice in Canetti.
Yeah. So this is Elias Canetti, as you might know him, presumably in his Zurich study, where he spent the last 30 or so years of his life. These are some data representing or give you a sketch of his bibliography and biography. Of course, he won the Nobel Prize in 1981. I marked in red color those titles of some of his most famous books that already indicate that hearing, speaking, telling, using the tongue play such a important role in his writing, like Die Stimmen von Marrakesch, the voices of Marrakesch, like Der Ohrenzeuge, his way to take up the Theophrastus genre of characters, so the ear witness instead of the eyewitness, and the first volume of his autobiography, Die gerettete Zunge, the saved tongue. The second volume, of course, reads Die Fackel im Ohr, the torch in the ear. I'll skip over to this, and you see, I just wanted to show you that, and of course, in the literature on Canetti, several scholars took on dealt with Canetti's notion of the acoustic mask. I'll talk about in a moment too. And this is very much my itinerary. I skipped the points D and F, of course, for time sparing reasons. Cacco la Gallinica, shouted the kids in the streets of Ruse, Rustchuk, a small town on the border between the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg Empire. It is Ruse, Elias Canetti's birthplace, and he narrates this episode that the kids shouted Cacco la Gallinica in the first volume of his autobiography, the volume that reads, as I said, Die gerettete Zunge, the saved tongue, published in 1977. A poorly dressed man, presumably a beggar, Canetti tells here, got hunted by children who scorned him as Cacco la Gallinica, Cacco the little hen. In the event, the man took on the his name and bursted into a chicken-like cackling. This incident is characteristic of the childhood soundscape Carnetti remembers and revocates in Die gerettete Zunge, der saved tongue. Ruse, as he calls it, with his German name Rustschuk, was a place of many ethnic groups. It's situated in what today is Bulgaria, was a place of many ethnic groups communicating in many languages: Bulgarian, Turkish, Romanian, Greek, Albanian, and Armenian people lived side by side with a group Carnetti calls simply Gypsies, Zigeuner, and with the Sephardic Jews his Carnetti's family belonged to. His native tongue, to be precise, his first mother tongue, if one could put it that way. Carnetti's first mother tongue was Spaniolo, the version of Spanish spoken by Sephardic Jews expelled from Spain in the wake of the Catholic Reconquista. Carnetti and his family considered it an article of pride to be speakers of Spaniolo. A dialect strangely deviating from pure standard language, the boy Elias Carnetti comes across only later at age 11 in Zurich, where his Swiss landlady admonishes him, "Nicht rührt sie auf meine Stuhlmacher," which means not to leave scratches on her chairs. You have the quote there. As Frau Vogler, that landlady's father, and her brother were conductors, one might read this as a rather cryptic trace of the first 20th century media to record voices, namely the disc, the scratches. Alongside this, the buzzing of the polyglot city of Ruse, foreign words and other tones entered its inhabitants' pronouncements when they quoted someone or when they sang something. Carnetti's text mimes this impressively. Although he states that he remembers in German the Bulgarian fairy tales he heard as a boy in their original Bulgarian language, for his linguistic fate, das sprachliche Schicksal, he calls as his own, precisely consisted in the fact that his memories have been, since the Ruse time, unconsciously translated into German. And although in Carnetti's autobiography, and although Carnetti's autobiography as a whole is indeed written in a splendid, classical, almost Goethe-like German, he quotes some key words of his early childhood in Spaniolo. On Sabbath, when the poor were to be invited to his family, he, the boy Carnetti, cried, as Carnetti writes some 70 years later, "Ziganas, Ziganas," which of course means gypsies, gypsies. And the first girl he kisses at a seven-year-old boy in Manchester, because her cheeks, he kissed that first girl because her cheeks reminded him of a song he had heard in Ruse. "Manzanicas coloradas las que vienen de Istanbul," colorful little apples, those that come from Istanbul. And Ruse now, the doctors from neighboring as well as far distant Vienna, namely Lorenz Schlesinger, Schnitzler, Neumann, Hayek, Halban, Freud is conspicuously absent here, were prominently present in conversations by means of their famous utterances, their Aussprüche, their aphoristic sentences or diagnosis or both, Aussprüche, were in the air. The memorableness of the Spaniolo song on the apples from Istanbul is uncannily echoed in the autobiographical narrative by Elias Canetti's recollection of his father singing, already then in Manchester, where they moved from Brussel, a German lied named Das Grab in der Heide, the grave on the heath. This song is almost the contains almost the last words the son heard from his father, who suddenly died in England at age 29. One may call this performance, as Canetti represents it, with his father singing accompanied on the piano by his wife, Elias's mother, one might call this an act of double code switching, from speaking into singing, and from Spagnolo and or from English to German. It sounds like a vocal, a sung last will, like a vocal testament. The duplicity just mentioned, however, is for Canetti a kind of firm rule. Time and again, when people, characters of his autobiographical narrative, switch to another language, their voice, he remarks, changes. His father, he notes, speaks differently, in a different manner, with a different tone, when speaking English. And both his parents entertain another kind of dialogue when they communicate in German. It is their German, is their intimate language, as they met each other in Vienna, where they both enthused about the performances at the Burgtheater, the main theater, the state-subsidized key central theater of the Austrian Empire and of Austria. His mother, Canetti's mother, loved to read, go to the theater, and she loved to read dramas. And his father, just like his own father, Elias Canetti's grandfather, had a histrionic talent. His father had to give up hope he could become an actor and accepted to work as a merchant next to Elias Canetti Sr., that grandfather, who in turn never stopped charming his neighbors, friends, and family members by telling stories about or thereby mimicking other people. Mock mimesis is indeed a major element and effect of fearing or listening to voices in Canetti. In Vienna, where the Canetti family moved after Jacques Canetti's sudden death in Manchester, there the Canettis check live-in housekeeper Fanny, a young woman from Bohemia, fences off the protracted area of a beggar that knocked at the apartment's door by finally resorting to copying that beggar, and I quote, and you have it here on the slide. Plötzlich warf sie sich selber auf die Knie und machte ihn nach. Jeden seiner Sätze bekam er in böhmischem Tonfall aus ihrem Mund zurück, und das Duett war so eindrucksvoll, dass ich die Worte mitzusprechen begann. All of a sudden she kneeled down herself and imitated him. Each of his sentences he got back with a Bohemian accent, and the duet of the beggar and that nanny was so impressive that I began speaking synchronically to it. At the core of Canetti's concept of metamorphosis, Verwandlung, transformation, metamorphosis via imitation, though, there is not mock mimesis, but mimesis as a magical means of admiring, taking on, taking over, living through the imitated other. His autobiography drastically shows this when it tells how Matilde Canetti, the 7-year-old boy's mother, forces her son to learn German after his father died, thus preparing the young Elias to fill the gap Jacques Canetti has left by dying. The author dubs his German eine spät und unter wahrhaftigen Schmerzen eingepflanzte Muttersprache, a mother tongue implanted onto him lately and under real pains. By stepping in as replacement for the significant other of Matilde Canetti's intimate conversation, he, the boy Elias Canetti, suffers and reenacts his second birth, literally his Wiedergeburt, he calls that he got Wiedergeboren, reborn. As his mother's, his Wiedergeburt, his rebirth as his mother's son and as his mother's second husband and as his mother's double, giving birth under pain. Intensity thus hallmarks utterances and voices that bridge distances. Distances in ethnic identity, namely distances from one language to another. Distances in cultural practice and register and organ stop, which means the distance from speaking to singing. Distances in space, from Arusha to Vienna, from Manchester to Arusha, and so on. Distances in time, from childhood to a much larger age, and from one generation, from the father, for instance, to the son, from one generation to another. Distance in state of mind, and first and, foremost, distances in emotional state. Four such emotional states that come along, or rather are shaped and brought about by such changing voices, four states of that kind could be named as love, defiance, shame, and aggression. Love, and the kind of voice that gets changed the moment a person is imbued with love, this goes without saying. The German language the boy Elias learned was and continued to be the discourse of intimacy. Aber die Sprache unserer Liebe, was war das für eine Liebe, wurde Deutsch. Yet the language of our love, and what kind of love this was German, Canetti writes, on himself and his mother. He had very much resistance to any Freudian theory, but it's a very Oedipal story he tells, of course. Yeah. Voice defiance came to the fore when Canetti and his two brothers found themselves surrounded by patriotic Austrians belting out the emperor's anthem, the so-called Kaiser Hymn, in order to hail the outbreak of World War I. When they did so, the boys countered that spontaneous performance with singing to the same tune, the rather British God Save the Queen, God Save the King by then. Feelings of shame emerge when a speaker's pronunciation of foreign words are not close enough, not in tune with how a native speaker would sound. Elias Canetti Sr., the grandfather, who boasted himself on speaking 17 to 19 languages, pronounced them, as his grandson tersely remarks, mangelhaft, faultily. Yet whereas he wins his audience over by that very defiance, family members in Manchester cruelly burst into laughter when the boy Elias Canetti faultily recites a French poem. This failure leaves him, the boy Elias Canetti, he tells us, humiliated and desolate. This failure repeats the frustration he felt when his cousin Laurika, back in Russia, refused him to open her first and to touch her first exercise books. He were, she said, so Canetti tells us some 70 years later, he were too young to even be allowed to touch those books. In German, it's sie, to touch her, which in Canetti's wording comprises both them, the exercise books, and her, the cousin Laurika, the girl. The boy avails himself of the Armenian refugee's axe, of an Armenian refugee's axe that was lying there in the court, and approaches Laurika with the axe in his hand, with the line of a Mordgesang auf den Lippen, a murderous tune on his lips. Again, still, this line is in Spaniolo. Agora vo matar a Laurika. Now I'm going to kill Laurika. But in the event, he doesn't do, but he comes close to that. And he admits that he was close to doing that, in fact. This change of tone, coming along with a state, with a change in emotional state, resonates with Canetti's ideas on metamorphosis via vocal mimesis as it transgresses the border between civilized humans and instinctual animals. In fact, voices that spread or overcome distances should have at least an undercurrent of ritual performance for Kennedy. Indirectly, almost seemingly by denying it, Kennedy here relates to his Jewishness. Although he says he enjoyed on Passover Seder to ask the Ma Nishtana question and sing together with the whole family the Aramaic Chat Gadya song. In spite of this, he shows little esteem for the yeshiva his mother sent him to. There in the Talmud school, the yeshiva, he says pupils were Ratschen, chat, which means that they would hastily murmur the prayers no one understood or got explained. And yet there is, according to Canetti, a mythical and ritual ring in performances and pronouncement of a foreign voice one appropriates without quite or at all knowing what one is doing, saying, singing, or performing. The person uttering, the person impersonating that foreign words, that foreign voice, reenacts a strange and powerful pattern going back to archaic layers of behavior, namely the hunting of the primitive man that takes on nature with an axe, agora va amatera, va matera laurica, the confrontation, identification with the hunted by the hunter, the impersonation of animal mimicry via human mimesis, the chiming in with animals or seriomorphic or superhuman deities. What Canetti cherished in such acts of mimesis, such imitations of another being's voice physiognomy, is its anthropological character. Thereby, the dramatist Canetti, and here you have a picture of one performance of one of his three dramas, began as, in a sense, as a dramatist, one could say, as a writer. The dramatist strove to overcome the conventions with this anthropological viewpoint. He strove to overcome the conventions of psychological theater. Instead, the characters in his dramas are bound to be stereotypical, artificial players, and not complex individuals modern culture and society does not accommodate. Der Hauptwiderstand, he wrote in 1942 in a note on drama in general, in Syria. Der Hauptwiderstand, den ich gegen die Entwicklung von Charakteren empfand, so als wären sie wirkliche lebende Menschen, erinnert daran, dass auch in der Musik die Instrumente gegeben sind. Sobald man sich einmal für ein Instrument entschieden hat, hält man daran fest, man kann es nicht, während ein Werk abläuft, in ein anderes Instrument umbauen. And German instruments are built, an Instrumentenbauer is someone that produces, say, a violin. Etwas von der schönen Strenge der Musik beruht auf dieser Klarheit der Instrumente, die Zurückführung, which means Zurückführung of dramatic characters, auf ein Tier lässt sich mit dieser Auffassung sehr wohl vereinen. Jedes Instrument ist ein ganz bestimmtes Tier. So I'm quoting that in, I have to say, my translation, the main opposition I felt against the development of characters as if there were real living human beings points to the fact that in music too, the instruments are given. After one has for a start chosen an instrument, one clings to it and cannot, while the work unfolds, rebuild it into another instrument. An element of the beautiful rigor of music rests on this clarity of instruments. The idea to trace back, which means to trace back a character in a drama, to an animal is easily reconcilable with this concept. Every instrument is a certain animal. In fact, Canetti praised some 40 years after he first got this, presumably, he praised a disc with animal noises, a disc he eagerly listened to at around the late 1930s, at least according to what he remembers on this in 1975. And he said on this disc, and I quote, "Das hat nicht nur als Ereignis die Form eines Dramas, denn es ist eine Jagd, die Erlegung eines Tieres, sondern ist auch stimmlich ganz das, ich hatte das Gefühl, das ist das größte Dokument, das mir je untergekommen ist für das, was ich eigentlich will." Sorry for that German long quote. "Die vielen Stimmen, die da sind in dem afrikanischen Dschungel, sind eigentlich für mich das Vorbild für das, was ich mit einem Drama will." Oh, here I have it into English, brought into English. "As a phenomenon, this," meaning the disc, "has not only the likeness of a drama, the disc with the animal voices, for it is a hunt, the slaying of an animal, it fits in terms of its vocal appearance too. I had the impression this is the most monumental document I ever came across, exemplifying what I really endeavored. The many voices present there in the African jungle are indeed to me the model of what I want a drama to be." Here Canetti voices what he has learned from Karl Kraus. "The performances of Krauss's public readings and the wordings of the articles Karl Kraus published in his periodical Die Fackel, The Torch, resonated in his Canetti's ear." That's why that second volume of his autobiography is called The Torch in the Ear. "In a Krausian vein, Canetti conceived of modern man as an alienated, grotesque being whose mind consisted of a limited set of stereotypical formulas and prescriptive prejudices. This he coined a character's acoustical mask, akustische Maske. This a character's torpid, fixed, wily, defensively aggressive vocal appearance. Canetti is literally writing in the 1930s, two dramas and the novel The Blendung, that's nowadays called in English Auto da Fe, but the first translation read The Tower of Babel. Canetti's literary works of the 1930s are witnesses to this anthropological lore. Later on, Canetti changed his position and postulated a writer, which means a real poet, a dichter, had the task to immerse himself into all beings, in fact, all beings of all times and all cultures, and by going through this series of self-transformations, get a sense of what human beings are behind the words they utter, was ein Mensch hinter sein worden ist, what a human being is behind, hidden behind what that human being utters. The German theater director Hans Hollmann stated in 1994 that the tension between a character's basic fears and hidden intentions, I should add, on the one side, and the character's masks on the other side, is what makes up for the peculiar quality of Canetti's plays. Thus, the masked Canetti, the author, the real poet, the dichter, the mask he dons are meant to fulfill their ancient media function. They reinforce the voice by altering it. They amplify and distort by calling it to being an appearance from beyond, an appearance that transcends, essentializes, raises, and repeals the world of inattentive, naturalistically repeated average perception. It remains, I should still talk for a few seconds on how this concept of voice and the acoustical mask relates to Canetti's obsessive interest in crowds, masks, power, and writing. Here, very briefly, critical voices and even a critique of voices should get touched on. Although Canetti's perceptions and representation of crowds, masses, is mainly a visual one, one of a large group of people, circus-like, assembled around a central site of attraction, prototypically a place that is on fire, that is set ablaze. In spite of this, he well knows of something like the acoustical footstep of crowds too. This footstep could consist in the singing of warmongers as the episodes of Austrians singing the Kaiser Hymne in 1914, shows or of soldiers. Canetti met in Vienna 1 or 2 years later, soldiers that were singing the very popular post-romantic German song, Ich hatte einen Kameraden, I had a comrade, but they were singing this as if they would bemoan their own being fallen already. And early, still quite seemingly peaceful experiences of the mass, of the crowd as noisy, is recalled by Canetti as being transmitted to him by the collective groaning and jubilation of the crowd in a nearby stadium watching a football match as fans of a Viennese club. Canetti's most intricate portrait of an aggressive crowd, however, is his recollection of Karl Krause's edicts turned hysterical by their master's public reading. Canetti, who had himself for a while belonged to these blind followers with the torch in the ear, dubs those intellectuals addicted to Karl Kraus' readings eine Hetzmeute von Intellektuellen, an agitated pack of intellectuals. So the torch in the ears might be metonymically connected to the pernicious fire of Nazi Germans burning books in May 1933. Canetti was eager of listening and of reading aloud, as well as of reading and being read. Some say he was the best impersonator of his own plays. Here you see him impersonating his own plays, of his own literary characters, like, for instance, those in his drama, those of the Blendung, of his Theophrast-like portraits, Der Ohrenzeuge, Die Ehrwitness, or of the short prose pieces of The Voices of Marrakesh. Quite a number of his public readings have been recorded and republished from archives of German radio stations in recent time. In an unpublished memo of the 1930s, Canetti reflected on how writing himself has become, with the advent of the typewriter, a noisy practice. This made him tentatively repeal his long-standing liking and predilection, preference, for the vocal side of language in order to opt for an anachronistically silent retreat into the realm of acoustically imperceptible writing, demonstratively different from anything a person or a machine could voice. Tellingly enough, I just gloss over this. Tellingly enough, though, the memo breaks off. Thank you very much.